form in which you would like to discuss the bill. Representative Gerlach, care to continue with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That pretty much summed it up, and I can stand for any questions right now. I know there are other folks that want to testify.
Thank you. Seeing no questions for the author, is there anyone else with us here this afternoon who would like to speak in favor of House File 561? Okay, seeing none, is Jennifer O'Rourke here with us? Ms. O'Rourke, if you would approach the microphone, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm here today and to make some comments on Representative Gerlach's bill, House File 561. First and foremost, we appreciate the opportunity to be before your committee, and I want to thank Representative Gerlach for everything he shared with us, from delete-alls to grids to meeting to work out some of the language that he, the amendment, that, it's just a, the oral amendment language that we talked about earlier. This bill still preempts local control in Section 2 of the bill, and we would be opposed to that because it preempts local control. And with that, I would stand for questions, and that would be it.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. O'Rourke. Is Jeremy Hansen here today? Good afternoon, Mr. Hansen. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm sorry, I'm going to be pinch-hitting for Jeremy Hansen. He was feeling ill. My name is Matt Florey. I represent the American Cancer Society, but I'm here to speak on behalf of the Smoke-Free Coalition on Jeremy's behalf as a member of that coalition. While we appreciate the work that Representative Gerlach has done, a lot of the good faith work to make some improvements in the bill, we do continue to have some concerns, the same ones shared by the League of Cities. Particularly Section 2, which preempts local authority to establish stronger penalties. These concerns are really rooted in public health literature. Last year when this bill was up in conference committee, the Commissioner of Health actually sent a letter opposing the bill, and in particular noted that public health literature, testimony from local elected officials and law enforcement officers, even the tobacco industry itself, clearly state that it is the power that is local control that makes the law effective. We believe the current law is effective at deterring youth smoking. Compliance rates are up to 85%, and we think that retailers that have problems should be able to redress those problems at the local level. From a public health perspective, we encourage legislators to continue to support the existing law.
Sir, before there any questions, if any, could you please give us your name again and spell it for our records here?
My name is Matt Florey, F-L-O-R-Y.
Thank you.
And I'm with the American Cancer Society.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else with us today who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 561? Is there any discussion of House File 561 amongst members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 561 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that we have someone from the city of Burnsville that wanted to say a few words.
Ah, okay. Good afternoon, ma'am. If you would state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Liz Workman. I am a member of the Burnsville City Council and have worked with Representative Gerlach. I'm sure he's tired of coming to Burnsville, but we do appreciate all the work and the efforts to get this as good as it can be. I personally am not 100% happy with the language in there, but then I have to believe neither is the Minnesota Retailers Association. So therefore, I draw the conclusion that it's probably a really good piece of legislation when no one is 100% happy. So I'm very, I would like to see this passed as is. It does not affect our best practices program in Burnsville. I don't believe it affects the ones in Plymouth, and this piece of this legislation would also allow other cities who are interested in starting a best practices program to do that. It's not cheap, but if they want to take on the task, they still can. So I would just like to thank you for your time and let you know that we appreciate Representative Gerlach's assistance in this.
questions for the witness? Seeing none, thank you. Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for the author. Representative Gerlach, Section 2 was pointed out, and it says that after this bill would be passed, that a local authority couldn't assess or impose a penalty greater than the administrative penalties set forth on our chart here. Is it possible for a local authority to assess a penalty less than what's put into law in this bill?
Thank you,
Representative Gerlach.
Representative Burrell. You would have to follow the minimums in here. The issue has never been about the minimums, it's always been about the maximums. So you just have to be within the window. We established windows. See, an upper and a lower and an upper.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in favor of this House file or in opposition to this House file? Seeing none, is there any further discussion amongst the committee with respect to this House file? Seeing none, Representative Latz.
Thank you. Representative Gerlach, is there a reason why there isn't any minimum period of suspension in the bill? I mean, none at all. You've removed the suspension floor entirely from existing law.
Representative Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Latz, we have in the chart, if you look here, we have for up to 3 days or up to 7 days. And the whole point is that if you're not doing all of the things we discussed in the other committee just a few minutes ago, your license can be suspended or revoked at any time for as long as needs be. The whole point is that this sort of funnels people into doing those things that we know will help prevent youth access to tobacco. So that's really the key here. I guess am I answering your question?
Representative Latz.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gerlach, it just seems to me, let's say they do all those things, they still have some, or they do them with a wink and a nod, knowing that they've got a high school nearby and you've got a lot of customers over there. How do we get at the retailer that still ends up with three sales or four sales in a 24-month period? If a city council wants to let them slide, there's no teeth there. There's not even says doesn't even require a 1 day suspension of their license. It allows for it, but it doesn't require it. It seems to me a $250 fine is nothing even if it's three or four times over, is nothing for the kind of retailers that are involved here in terms of their daily business.
Representative Gerlach.
Representative Latz. That's the whole premise of this bill. What started this was not the angle of the question you're pursuing, which is to think that cities are not imposing enough penalties, or it's the opposite has been the case, where penalties are becoming too onerous and taking businesses away. And having severe financial penalties based on those license suspensions and revocations. And so that's always been the focus of the problem. It's not, in all the discussion of this bill, it has never been a discussion point about what if a city council is going to let someone slide. I guess if a city council is going to let someone slide, then they, what are you going to do about that? We just heard about local control and preserving local control. I guess it's a balance point between trusting the cities are going to do what's right, and I think they will, I don't see that I don't think that this is going to be a problem.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion of the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 561, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gerlach. Is Representative Wilson with us? Hey, Representative Sikora.
I'll go get her.
Representative Pugh. All right, next door doesn't cut it. First come, first serve. Hey, Mark Olson, if you grab him, Dennis, his office is right out back there.
Hey, where is he?
Hey, Ray, and you were talking about wanting to get your bill up.
I think you're trying.
I aim to please.
Okay.
I know. This is like dead space on the radio.
Sweet.
Representative Pugh, you ready?
Sure.
All right, let's do it.
So hurry up, Bob.
Absolutely. I've got a bill up in a while. Hey, Representative Pugh, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 1972 be recommended to pass.
General Register.
Representative Pugh moves that House File 1972 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Pugh, if you'd proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair and members, this bill relates to disposal of abandoned vehicles. We have a situation in Minnesota law where, under which the owner of a repair facility, body shop, mechanical shop, has but one remedy if an automobile or vehicle is abandoned at their facility. Under law, we have a number of provisions where a private property owner, or if a vehicle is left on the public street, the vehicle can be determined to be abandoned and disposed of with some relative ease. In the situation that you're about to hear from Dave Steffens, who's a mechanical shop owner, we have numbers of instances in which people will take a car or have a car towed to a shop, decide that the repairs might exceed the value of the vehicle, and they decide not to pursue the repairs. They also decide never to retrieve the vehicle. And under Minnesota law, the only way that the repair shop can proceed is to have the call in a sheriff, and there's a sheriff's sale provision for the vehicle. It's costly. To have the sheriff's sale. It's also at the end of the sale, since it's a car of little or no value, there's no buyer. The shop then becomes the owner of the vehicle and they can dispose of the vehicle. This amendment to the statute that we're proposing puts a body shop, a repair shop, in the same situation as anybody else under Minnesota law, owner of private property. They do have to give notice to the person that the vehicle is being abandoned, has been abandoned, will be determined to be abandoned, and will be disposed of. They give that notice, and following that notice, they can then have the vehicle towed and disposed of as other businesses. It's a, we believe, a blip in Minnesota law because a bailment is created when the customer has the auto delivered to the shop. There's a potential contract bailment that's created, and because of that, they've been hampered in disposal. But I do have with me today Mr. David Steffens, who's a shop owner in this area. He can talk of the problem and the problem that his association of fellow owners of repair shops have tried to deal with. Good.
Mr. Steffens, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is David Steffens. I run an automobile repair facility in northeast Minneapolis. I will be brief. I've been here a long time. I realize the importance of being brief.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is David Steffens. I am the owner of Dave Steffens Automotive in Minneapolis. I've been in the automobile repair business for over 40 years. And I've been active in our trade association, the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers, for the past 25 years. I currently serve as chair of the association's Government and Regulatory Affairs Committee. I wear this tie today out of respect to the legislator and the committee. A couple hours ago, I was on the shop floor in a uniform, so I know from what I'm talking here. I want to thank you for scheduling a hearing on Representative Pugh's bill, House File 1972. Representative Pugh's bill provides a remedy for repair shops who find themselves in possession of vehicles which the owners clearly no longer intend to recover. Virtually every repair shop has to deal with vehicles abandoned on their premises. I brought this photo of the cars that were abandoned just in January. You'll see an older Volkswagen and a mid-80s Cadillac. In February, I took another photo. The Volkswagen is still with us. The mid-80s Cadillac we were able to plead our way out of, but it's been replaced by an early 90s Jeep. There's a number of reasons vehicle owners abandon their vehicles. The estimated cost of the repair might be more than the customer can afford. The estimated cost of the repair might be more than the vehicle is worth. The cost of having the vehicle towed to the facility is often greater than the vehicle is worth. In any case, we end up with the vehicle on our hands and no easy way to dispose of it. Currently, a repair shop would have to go through a sheriff's sale process in order to get rid of the vehicle. This involves a lot of work and significant expense. In fact, this process involves time, energy, and the resources of the sheriff's office as well to deal with vehicles that often have little or no value in the marketplace. If there is a significant value in the vehicle, of course we would pursue the sheriff's sale. But House File 1972 would allow a shop to have the vehicle towed off their premises without incurring any civil liability to the vehicle owner if it's below the value of holding a sheriff's sale. Under this authority, the repair shop would receive nothing. We're simply able to have the vehicle towed off our premises. I know you're concerned with the vehicle owner's rights, but as far as the vehicle owner's rights are concerned, they still retain title to the vehicle, and they would have an opportunity for recovery of the vehicle through the process which the towing companies must use to dispose of abandoned vehicles. Same as if they had towed it off the street, same as if it was a snowbird. The vehicle owner would receive a notice from a repair shop, from us, before the vehicle is towed, and then he would again receive notice from the towing company prior to the time that the vehicle was disposed of. Mr. Chairman, members, we think this is a reasonable approach which ensures that these vehicles are handled in a manner which respects the ownership interest of the vehicle owners, but allows repair shops to move vehicles without causing a blight on the community or public safety concern in their communities. We respectfully request that you support this measure. I'd be pleased to respond to any questions that anyone on the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Steffens. Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Pugh, Mr. Steffens. My concern pivots on page 2, line 10, about the identity of the vehicle owner. Is there any effort to, or maybe you can tell me about the effort that you use to determine who actually owns the vehicle, as opposed to who may well drop it off at your place for repairs? It might not be the same person.
Yes.
And that the vehicle owner, in fact, gets the proper notice.
The vehicle owner.
Mr. Steffens.
He just acknowledges you for the tape.
The vehicle owner is identified under the notification procedures that the towing companies use and that we use. So my personal method so far, failing in having a law in place, is that we phone the numbers that we have on our repair order. If that turns out not to be the vehicle's owner, we will just go by the license plate number, identify the vehicle owner, and send him a registered letter.
Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Chairman DeForest. Mr. Steffens, my concern is I decide to go to Florida for the climate, lend my car to Representative Coles, who, because of his poor driving record, smashes it, brings it to your place, lists himself on the repair order. When he gets the bill, he says, well, that's way too rich, and I don't think Lippman's car was worth that. And abandons the car. If you contact him, I may well be in Florida and never get notice that it's in receipt of a towing company or some other process. Or, do I have a recourse against you if you didn't notify the vehicle owner if this bill were to pass? I mean, what are the true owner's remedies if they didn't get notice?
Mr. Steffens.
I'm not familiar with the provisions of the bill as far as notification goes.
Okay.
Kevin Wally was supposed to be here to speak to this, and I don't see him in the room. I have to plead ignorance in this case. In my case, I'm a mechanical repair shop, so your analogy of a collision is even out of my area of expertise. Again, how much would you pay to fix this car?
Right.
These are the issues, as far as I'm concerned. So I can only speak to that. Maybe Representative Pugh has.
Representative Pugh.
I'll try, at least my interpretation of what would be going on. I believe that this, Mr. Chair and Representative Littman, I believe that this legislation would require notice to the owner rather than the person who requested repairs. The language seems clear in the bill to that effect. It does, however, on I forgot an earlier version, so I'm not sure which lines. It does limit civil liability for someone who follows this procedure. But if, in fact, the notice was made to, in your example, to Representative Coles rather than to you, it would appear to me that the noncompliance with the notification procedure, the owner, the shop owner, would not be insulated from any claim by you. That would be my intention, the way this that I read it as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for either the author or Mr. Steffens? Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Chairman De La Forest. Now, Representative Pugh, why the 5-day notice versus a 10-day, 15-day, 30-day, some other number?
Representative Pugh?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burrell, I don't know that there's any necessary magic to that. I'll let Mr. Steffens answer. Maybe that in their association looking at this, they came up with a rationale for that. I should mention there would be another notice as well. This is just the first step. The shop would notify the owner, the 5-day notice. The vehicle would then be turned over to a towing company, who then, in their disposal procedure, has to notify the owner again as well. And I think that's a 10 or
15-day
notification. So there would be two notices. I don't know if you're open to changing the time frame.
Mr. Steffens.
I'm not caught up in that 5 days. However, the procedure is once it's removed from my premises, then it would go to the towing company's premises, which would give the owner a total of 20 days. And that seemed adequate by the way we were looking at it because of the delay time built into the towing company's disposal process. So if your car were abandoned on the street, you would only get 15 days to retrieve it. If your car were abandoned in your front yard, the owner would only have 15 days to retrieve it. If your car was taken to my facility, abandoned there, you would have at least 20 days to retrieve it. It just seemed fair. We didn't want to add costs because the realism of it is that every day that car is there, that's a parking space that I don't have.
Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Steffens, do you think that repair shops would maybe put a notice if this law went into effect that said if a vehicle is abandoned, so when you give them an estimate of repair, it might even say right on there that we have the right after 5 days of not hearing from you to send you a certified letter and have the vehicle moved? Do you think that might be something that you would put on your estimate of repair?
Mr. Steffens.
We would definitely do something like that. Perhaps post a sign and then again tell the owner that we have the right to have that car removed to a towing facility or something like that. Our aim is not to beat up on the public. Our aim here is to stop this problem of people storing their valueless cars on our property. And by giving notice, we would further that. We would never have to go through this process if we said, there is a state law in place that will allow me to tow this car out of here in 5 days, so please make your decision in a contemporary fashion. I think that would serve our needs better than a written law. But before I can say that, there has to be such a law.
Thank you. Is there anyone with us today who wishes to speak in favor of House File 1972? Is there anyone with us today who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 1972? Seeing none, is there any final discussion amongst the committee regarding House File 1972? Seeing none, Representative Pugh, would you care to renew your motion?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Your Honor. I would renew my
motion. Please don't call him that. Representative Pugh renews his motion that House File 1972 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The recommendation is adopted.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Thank you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we will revert back to our stated agenda today. Representative Olson, House File 1688.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill needs to be referred back to Transportation Policy.
The Chair will move House File 1688 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. Representative Olson, do you have any author's amendments?
There's one in the packet, but we're withdrawing that amendment. It deals with transportation policy, and my understanding from the Chair that wants to keep those issues out of the committee. They belong in transportation policy.
So it's my understanding, Representative Olson, that you will not be presenting the DE1 amendment, and so House File 1688 as written here is in the form in which you'd like to discuss it?
That's correct.
Great, thanks. And we'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Representative Mark Olson, District 16B, and it's my understanding the primary function here with this committee in bringing a bill like this here has to do with the constitutional provision itself and the concern of putting this language, or excuse me, this whether or not this issue is relevant, germane, and so forth to the Constitution as it's written. And this amendment proposed here would amend Article 14. And just for your recollection, that has to do with our public highway system. And it currently has provisions in it to dedicate the motor fuel tax, taxation on motor vehicles, and the motor fuel tax, the gas tax. And it gives specifics on how that's dedicated. And what we're doing here is simply attempting to dedicate more of those revenues and constitutionally dedicate them so that we have a completely user-funded highway system and not and end this battle between the general fund and some of these highway user dollars. That's simply it. The Minnesota Transportation Alliance supports this bill. Bob Vanosik is here from the Metropolitan Inter-County Association. If you'd like to hear more testimony, we can. But those, I know, matters relate more so to transportation policy. So in being sensitive to the committee's time, if this is sufficient, if there's any questions, I'll take them at this time.
Are there any questions for the author? Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, I guess how broad is the term public assistance to public transit systems? I guess I'm just trying to understand what your is it only buses and rails and PRT and nothing else that could be that would follow from this, or
are you can you speak exactly?
Forgive me. Page one. Lines 18 and 19. You know, all revenue must be deposited, dedicated solely to the assistance of public transit systems in the state. And I'm just wondering. Are roads a public transit system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, my understanding of public transit systems would be transit, not highways. And that's further spelled out by defining how some of the dollars go to the highway. I mean, everything in the Constitution right now is dedicating to the highway system. So this is one addition to the getting us to the point of why we're here before this committee. The only expansion we have of language in the Constitution is that everything currently in the Constitution dedicates to the highway system. This is to transit. So the question really before us pertaining to the purview of this committee has to do with, is that an inappropriate expansion within the Constitution?
Representative Lippman.
Just so that I can answer that question for myself, Chairman De La Forest, Representative Wilson, I'm just trying to understand what it is that your bill does. Now, I'm not trying to mm-hmm. interfere in the transportation jurisdiction, but just so we can fulfill ours. Motor vehicle excise tax and fuel tax, the gas tax, would go into a fund limited to buses, rail, PRT, those types of modalities, when they're currently being used to fund roads. Have I got it correctly?
Representative Olson. Mr. Chair, Representative Lippman, this bill only pertains to the motor vehicle tax. The other taxes are already dedicated. This only pertains to the motor vehicle tax, and in particular, this bill takes the new vehicle purchases, the taxes from the new vehicle purchases, dedicates that to transit, and all remaining taxes dedicated to the highway system. Now, that's going to change in transportation policy, and we're not supposed to address that here in this committee, but that's going to change in transportation policy. It's going to end up being a 25-75% breakdown or something on that order, instead of tinkering with the new car purchase, taking the new car purchase approach.
Representative Lippman. One final one, just so that, because I'm slow and not familiar with these issues. Chairman De La Forest, Representative Olson. The question presented to us is it appropriate to put into the Constitution an MVET dedication in favor of transit?
Representative Olson. Mr. Chair, Representative Lippman, yeah, basically, an MVET transfer as it pertains to transit. However, it's not all going to transit. It's also going to highways.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for the author? Seeing none, is there anyone with us today who feels compelled to also speak in favor of House File 1688? Seeing none, is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 1688? Seeing none, is there any further discussion amongst the committee with respect to this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1688 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. The motion prevails. The recommendation is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right, Representative Sikora.
Did you notice I've been waiting?
Well, it's interesting to watch the in and out flow of those who have bills up.
Well, some of us are supposed to be in two other places at the same time as this place.
Yeah, we haven't perfected the technology.
Some of us, too.
We haven't gotten very good at that yet, have we?
Well, then, Representative Coro, welcome to the committee. I will be sending House File 1789 off to Education Finance.
No, going to Government Operations first.
Going to Government Operations, okay.
And I have one small amendment also.
Okay, Representative Coro, what we'll do is I will move that House File 1789 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations. Now, if you'd care to speak to your author's amendment.
Well, the author's amendment is very simple. On page 13 and on page 17, at three different times total, we are adding an effective date that was overlooked when this was put together. So if you want to look at that, page 13, it's after lines 23 and 28.
Representative Sikora, is this the 0970 amendment that
yes.
we have in front of us?
Yes, okay. I'm sorry. That's the only amendment.
Okay. So, members, we have before us the 0970 amendment. Are there any questions for the author? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the 0970 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Sikora, is the bill now in the form in which you'd like to discuss it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And the area that we need to discuss is on page 16. I think this is the area that applies to civil law. And it's on school performance report cards. If you recall, the first year last year, there were school performance report cards, which it's now in law that we do those. And what happened last year is they were published early. Some of the districts had made mistakes, and so all that data was put out there, and then their mistakes were corrected, and the correct data was then published, et cetera. What we'd like to do is keep this as private data until the corrections have been made, and then publish it all on the website as we're supposed to. It's not good to have inaccurate data out there, and it's very upsetting to parents and schools if they're put out there as not making adequate progress, when in fact they have. Mr. Marcus will address the issue.
Good afternoon, Mr. Marcus. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair De La Forest, my name is Greg Marcus. I'm from the Minnesota Department of Education and here hopefully to be able to speak on the details of the provisions before you. The department as the representative indicated, was charged to create both a state report card, but then also in our effort to comply with federal law, we provide data called adequate yearly progress determinations. Both of these are formed on the student-level data that we have by way of what's called the MARS system. The MARS system is a payment system primarily that is also able to tell us the particular situation that a child is in, their ethnicity and things of that nature. Because the MARS system was primarily used as a payment system and not as an accountability measure, districts have historically not taken that as seriously, the accuracy of that data as seriously as they might have. Now that we are using this data in a way that speaks to accountability purposes, they are becoming accustomed to the fact that they need to get this data correct and pay more attention to it. However, because we're all human, because we make errors, there will still be times when the data that the districts give to the department will not be in the form that the district wishes it to be. So what we propose to do is to allow there to be a 30-day window where we take the MARS data and the other test data and other information that gets put into the state report card and into the adequate yearly progress calculation, and we will keep that data and those initial determinations as non-public data. It'll be between the district and the MDE, the Minnesota Department of Education, for a 30-day period during which the districts have the opportunity to go online and correct the base data that we're using for our calculations. So they will know what their AYP, their adequate yearly progress determination is. They will know how they turn out looking on the report card. They will have 30 days in which to correct any errors that might have contributed to an erroneous determination on either of those measurements, and then that data will become public after that point. We believe that this is in the best interest of schools because we don't think it is a good idea to be raising concern where it is not justified. Therefore, correct data is better data to share. We also think that it will allow for the more efficient treatment of schools that truly do need to have concern spent over them. So we do think it's a matter that speaks towards efficiency. It increases confidence in our public school system. And it is something that is supported both by the Superintendent's Association, the Minnesota School Board Association, and many others that are contributing and vested interests in the world of education.
Thank you. Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Chairman De La Forest. Representative Segura, Mr. Marcus, well, and first, welcome back. It's good to see you here. I think it's a great policy. I guess my question is more pedantic than that. I'm just wondering about the term of art, its public website. It seems a little clumsy. I'm just wondering if there's a better set of terms that we could use as this measure goes forward. Probably not our finest, not the worst language, but not our finest hour either. I wonder if you had any reply.
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippman, thank you. Indeed, that is a good observation, and if there is better language, we are eager to adopt it. This was put forward to people in our area, that work in the technology area of the Minnesota Department of Education, knowing that there are some areas that we have semi-public, some things that are just, we try to tailor towards administrators. And this was the best term of art that they could think of. That's not to say it is; it flows off from one's tongue. And so, if there is a better phrase, we're open to that.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. If I might, just for clarification purposes, when you get to Subdivision 2 and you talk about after the district, after the department makes sure that everything is right, and if there's a challenge, that everything is public, is that, their first round, the challenge information, what was right, what was wrong, could a member of the public, once it's made public, have access to every step of the process from the time they started turning in the information?
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, a very good question. The department has historically screened data of this nature down to gradations of 10 students, the thought being that if we have if we're revealing information about groups of kids that are smaller than 10, in situations where you have small schools in rural areas, it will be easy enough to determine, or it might be easy enough to determine which kid we were talking about. And so in a desire to not have it kind of personally identifiable action happen, we have screened just to the level of 10, never gone below 10 as far as making that sort of thing publicly available. Schools, those that are involved with the education of the kid, have the data for those that have a need to know the data down to the kid level. They know which students have failed and which students have passed on the various assessments, which students are receiving free and reduced lunch, which ones aren't.
Representative Holbrook.
I'm going to try again, and I don't know much about education, so I'll try and talk more in a policy perspective. My understanding of what happened in the past is the school district sent in these numbers. They were digested to some degree by the department and then put out publicly. The school districts went, oh my gosh, we messed up. Our school really isn't this, it's that. A member of the public could say that the Department of Education and Lakeville Public Schools were in it together. They sanitized the report. You know, how do we know that in the process of the first time we gave you information and this 30-day review process and what actually comes out, how does the public track or have accountability to know what was originally put in? How did we justify the changes and what the final report reflects? It is every document in that process public after your 30-day review process?
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, a fine question. And certainly everything at the Department of Education that doesn't speak to student-specific data is publicly accessible. It is public data, except for the parameters around not having personally identifiable pieces of information shared with the public. And so to the extent that there would be computer runs and other paper that would show the progression of a school from one identified category to another identified category 30 days later, after this correction period, that would be public data to the extent that wasn't revealing personally identifiable information.
All right, thank you.
Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess my question kind of goes along those lines and could be to Mr. Marcus or Chair Sikora. The type of data that we're talking about is that there's like 38 different little subgroups where we measure the performance of the school, and it's the data that accumulates up into those little subgroups of 10 or 20 or more students that we're talking about in these reports. Is that correct?
Mr. Marcus.
Chair LaForest, Representative, that is partially correct indeed. As an addition to the adequate yearly progress determinations that are made, the state report card is also tied into this data. So the state report card may not operate under quite those same parameters, but certainly you are at least partially correct.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marcus or Representative Sikora, other than the fact that we're all people and we all make mistakes sometimes, why are our school districts making these mistakes in the first instance? Is there an explanation for why there's a problem with this data when it first comes to the department?
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that there are at least a couple of reasons, and not having worked in a school district in that situation, I am speaking not from firsthand experience, but speculating. I think the first is that these were not high-stakes data initially. And to the extent that there might have been an error, for instance, you were recording a student as being a particular ethnicity or particular having a particular language as a primary language, if there was an error of inclusion, that would be something that would be caught ultimately in the mix some as 12 to 18 months down the road when they did some Mars reconciliation, some book checking. Or if it wasn't caught, it wouldn't matter that much. It might even benefit you a little bit. But the bottom line is that these weren't used for high-stakes data, and the process of correcting, there is a process for correcting Mars data, but it is one that takes many months, so districts weren't previously under the, didn't feel previously under the same timeline to get their corrections made. I think that would be the chief reason, and the second, of course, would be that, like most institutions, people have a lot to do, and they prioritize those things that are, in their minds, most important. Historically, the Mars data was something that wasn't seen as being all that important. It was relegated to someone who had additional responsibilities.
Nobody looked at it much.
Any additional questions? Representative Coles.
Just a brief follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. Well, I guess I'm still a little confused because now this data is high-stakes data. And I guess are we, in a sense, encouraging complacency on the part of our school districts, giving them a free second bite at the apple, if you will? Shouldn't we be encouraging our districts to get it right the first time?
Mr. Marcus.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would. The commissioner is very sensitive to wanting to be the most supportive and productive department and commissioner that we can be. And in order to do that, it helps us to be able to engender the trust and support of public schools. It is for that reason that we're pursuing this, because we did hear some complaints about the way the process had gone previously. To your point of whether this would engender complacency, I do believe that we have representatives from the School Boards Association who would have a closer tie to schools and might be better able to answer that question.
Madam Chair, I hope they will when they come up.
All right, thank you, Mr. Cole. Welcome to the committee. You'll state your name for the record, please.
Ray Frost with the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and Madam Chair, and Representative, to my good friend, Mr. Marcus, we have a little bit of a disagreement here, and the school boards can tell you this too. The data is reported by the department. The school districts don't make the initial incorrection. They have to, the department reports out. And then the school districts want to see it before they report it. That's the problem. The kids take the test, the information goes to the department. The department then reports it out. We don't report it out. We don't. It goes to the department. The department reports it. What we're saying is, before it goes out publicly, and then parents start calling everybody, including you, saying our school district is failing because it comes in the Pioneer Press front page, we want to say, well, let's make sure the data is right before it goes out. And we want to look at the Mars stuff that the department has and then make any corrections.
Any additional questions for this witness? Certainly. Representative Sikora.
I think one of the differences is now we're getting a lot more data. We used to report aggregate scores, and now we're reporting out how different groups are doing. And I think we never did that before, and so that's a little different. And a lot easier to make mistakes, too, because you're looking at a lot of subgroups and how they are performing as a group.
Madam Chair, I mean, what the intent here is to report proper and correct data to the public. That's all it is. We don't want headlines in the newspaper saying that school districts are failing, or here's the school districts that are not doing well, if in fact they are. Why do we need to put stuff in the paper or anywhere else that's false? I don't know why anybody would want to put anything in the paper that's false. I don't understand it.
Representative Swanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Frost. So I'm understanding you right, that you're supportive of the bill. Is that right?
Madam Chair, absolutely.
Yes. I thought I understood you correctly.
Yeah.
All right. Any additional questions for this witness? I also have Mr. Anfinson on the list. Are you speaking? for or against this bill? Let me guess.
When the issue of false information in newspapers come up, I leave the debate.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Newspaper Association. I was just saying under my breath, there's lots of good reasons for putting false information in newspapers, but we would never do that. Madam Chair, I will be brief. A couple of the committee members have made the points I wanted to make. Reasonable minds can differ about this, but our concern is that by reclassifying the data in the way the bill proposes, it will greatly reduce public engagement and involvement in what is indisputably the most vital institution in the community. I have with me a previous witness talked about the Pioneer Press. I thought I'd use the Star Tribune as my example, and these are articles, copies of articles from last summer. The first is July 8th, state named schools that must improve. This is when the preliminary data about the report card came out, and it identified 259 schools that were purportedly failing based on the initial round of data. 5 weeks later, another front page article, 144 schools listed as failing. So now this is the final report. 5 weeks later, practically half the schools on the initial report are gone. Now, it could all be false information, and the process of correcting that is a good one. But to echo something the chair said earlier, how do we know that this process is entirely reliable? And I would love to sit here and say that all human beings could distinguish between true and false data, but nobody knows better than an attorney for newspapers that that is not possible to do always. And so what you lose here is a really significant level of public engagement between the initial report and the final report. As parents and community members do react, do call, do freak out, they should. This is their school system, and do we want to make that? I think the chair made a good point. This data will apparently still be public that came in earlier, but I will guarantee you the amount of reporting, the level of engagement in going back and looking at that stuff will not compare to this. This is, I would submit to you, this kind of stuff is great for the school system, the public school systems in Minnesota, and ought to be not discouraged. I must say in closing, I have a whiff of information control going on here. God bless our school administrators and school boards.
Mr. Anthonson, you held up the headlines from two different newspaper reports. What is the difference if you have access to all the data after the 30 days that you can say 30 days ago there was 296 schools, but today after a double check we're down to 144, then you don't have the parents freaking out in 145 schools? But you still have the information.
Well, Madam Chair, I think there should be some encouragement to engage them on the first round, because I mean, it's not a pure, clear line between a failing school and a not failing school. I assume, without being any kind of an expert on this, that there are many schools that will be close to either side of the line. Yes, you could theoretically go back and look at that data, but it will not have the same impact. And you where the school is even arguably close to the line, even if in the final report it falls below it, you should have that engagement. And to echo Representative Cole's comment, there's a separate question of how the districts have done this and why in this, at least this round, well, more than almost half of them didn't get it right apparently. So.
But I guess for clarification purposes, I think we just heard that it was the department that reported the data on the students that they had. I'm seeing heads nod.
The process itself needs light shown on it. The final point I'd make also is this last story is published as prominently as the first story. And so And newspapers are always fair about correcting the record as well.
Yeah, you know, that's very true.
This idea that for a 3 or 4 or 5 weeks there's a horrible catastrophe in the community because people think their school is failing. Is that so bad as to deter this level of public engagement? I guess we submit it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience like to speak to this issue? Mr. Neumeister, welcome to the committee. You'll state your name for the record,
Madam
please.
Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I echo Mr. Ampinson's point about sunshine. One of the points I just want to raise, though, is talking to at least Mr. Carlson, who represents the Metropolitan School Districts, I believe talking to him, who is support. He was one of the reasons, he shared with me one of the reasons for this. It was that because this is the first year, or this was the first year of doing these school reports, mm-hmm. and it was sort of like a half year kind of thing, that they didn't have the full year's data. I don't know if that's correct or not. In other words, this report that was done, I just want to make that, you know, I'm just going by, and that's maybe one of the reasons why they got that wrong, you know, this why there was the wrong of the numbers between the 200 and so many schools and the 140. Secondly, the concern I have if they don't meet the September 1st deadline on the website, which they may or may not. I would like if the language is not going to change. You know, if they don't meet this, put it on the website by September 1st, just become all. Automatically all public. It's seen at September 1st. And I don't know what the timeline is of how the information is given to the department, and then the department correlates it all together. Because that's for me, I didn't hear in the testimony. So I just sort of want, you know, if they don't do it by September 1st, the public should know. Boom. Everything should become public.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Are there any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair, I didn't have a question, but I think he raises a good concern that if I didn't catch it at first when I was first reading this, but the department is required to post by September 1st, but doesn't, because they haven't posted, the posting of it is what changes the classification. It should probably read something like, until the department posts the data to its public website or September 1st, whichever comes first, whatever, something like that. So it would trigger it if they fail to post. Otherwise, you'd have to have a lawsuit to force them to post if they miss the September 1st deadline.
That would be fine.
I'm sure Ms. McKnight could do a better job than I can on the language.
Ms. McKnight.
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, I think it's in the bill on page 17, line 6. See that the department shall annually post adequate yearly progress data to its public website no later than September 1st.
Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair and Ms. McKnight, the concern is that the data classification changes upon the posting to the website. That sentence you cited does require a posting by September 1st, but in the event they don't do that, the data
okay. So you can have that for insurance, in other words.
Right.
All right.
I think that's a very generous motion.
Actually, that's covered in
bribes. Maybe in that section, the section.
The first department post.
I'm sorry, Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Pugh's point, if we went on page 16, line 30, and just after the word until, after subdivision 9, until September 1st or the department posts the data to its public website might be a, and they're probably in the next subdivision 2, they probably need a similar wording in order to accomplish what Representative Pugh and Mr. Neumeister are attempting.
If I might, Mr. Marcus, could you return to the stand? What is the time frame? Do these reports come at the end of the school year? Are they due to the department July 1st? I mean, we talk about 30 days, but are these reports continually coming in, or how does it work?
Madam Chair, representatives, the key part of this, there are a number of pieces of data that come in, but the key part of the data, I think, for this discussion is probably the test data, which arrives from the test vendor sometime in the early summer, my recollection is, and I apologize that I don't have specifics, but then that is wed with the MARS data that we previously spoke about, the student level data telling whether a kid is LEP or whether they're a member of a particular ethnicity or free and reduced lunch. Those pieces of information are wed, and together they generate this adequate yearly progress determination. This last year, the AYP data calculation in preliminary form was done on July 7th, and that was posted to the web then. This first go-around, it was public at that point, and then 30 days later, approximately on about August 7th, is when the 30-day correction window, as we called it, closed. That during that preceding month, after we posted the initial data, the districts had the ability to go online and to correct any erroneous information about students' classification, whether they're LEP, whether they're not receiving special education services, those sort of things.
I mean, looking at this, maybe it's more appropriate to just put like a 45-day window, because if you're getting data throughout the course of the year, reports are going to change. Who cares about September 1st? Once you guys figure it out, it should be public, whether it's June or February. And so I'm not sure the posting to the website for the September 1st, I don't understand why what that has to do with whether it's public or not. Representative Burnett, help us out here.
I think the language is pretty clear. The triggering event for changing it from non-public to public is the posting. Whether it takes place on September 1st or the department screws up and misses it until 10th, it's the date of posting that clears. So the first sentence in that section, E, is clearly referring to the triggering time for which that converts. So I think the September 1 date is really, it's a requirement for them to post it, but it has nothing to do with the conversion of public, non-public. So I think the language is clear here as it's stated.
But if I might just, what if the time frames change? I mean, they could conceivably get data in January, have it challenged, and it not become public until September 1st. Whether or not the data is posted to a website should have nothing to do with its classification. From the testimony that I've heard, the issue is time frame, as far as how long a challenge takes. Whether or not it's on a website, sitting on somebody's computer, or in a file cabinet somewhere, the public should have access to it, whether or not it's on a website.
But I think the point of the bill, Madam Chair, is that the schools want to be able to react to correct an error before it becomes into the public domain. Right. And so there has to be some mechanism by which at least the department and schools communicate without it being published, in which they can correct the obvious errors. And I think this bill works.
It's about
it. Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair, perhaps I'm following and agreeing with your suggestion. It's the posting to the website isn't this appeal process and resolution occurs before that. The website is the final. Your suggestion is that once they have the information, they made a decision about South St. Paul, they have 45 days, then it's public. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
If
the press wants to know and it's determined by June 1st, you know, or whatever, then why shouldn't it become public once the conflict is resolved, and having a maximum period of days to do it makes the department get on the stick, look at the challenge, figure it out, make a resolution. And if it's another 3 weeks till it gets posted, why should it not be accessible until it's posted if it's already been determined?
Tracking with you, Madam Chair. But it may be wrong.
You know, I mean, I don't. We can move this bill out of here, but I do. I don't. I think it should be the issue should be the time frame for the challenge, not where you're going to put the information, what month of the year it is. What you're asking for is to shield this information for a limited period of time to make sure it's accurate. And your reports are going to change. Your time frame's going to change. How you do things are going to change. There's going to add more stuff to this. You might end up at a point where they're going to want reports to come out by July 1st so people can pick which school they're going to go to by August 1st. So let's just figure out a way to do it, a limited time frame for any of this data to be shielded while the school districts make sure it's correct, and that take the times and just put a time frame in, and we can work on that in the meantime. Any other questions? Where's the bill going? I missed
government the government operations.
Okay, and who made the original motion? Okay, Representative DeLaForest. Any other questions, comments? Okay, Representative DeLaForest renews his motion that House File 1789, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam.
Sorry that you had to stay so late today. And somebody help me out here. Do we have one bill? Representative Pugh.
We did it already.
Oh, how nice. So we're done?
Yeah.
You want to stay longer.
Okay, we do have a meeting scheduled for this Friday at 9 a.m. And it should go about 3 hours, is that my best guess. That's what I'm trying to hold it to. Next week we will meet Tuesday at our regular time, Wednesday at our regular time, and we've also reserved all day Friday the 12th. So that's what we're looking at for next week, given that it's deadline week and the number of bills that appear to be heading our way. So if any of you are not able to attend either of those Friday meetings, let us know. And hopefully we won't be here real long on the 12th, but I can't guarantee that. Any questions? It's adjourned. Thank you very much.